For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning, everybody. We've got some people who are here for the first time, so welcome. I hope things are okay so far. I see some people who introduced themselves the other night as being from Bloomington, so thank you for joining us this morning. And we got some people from Hyde Park, Southside, so thanks, everybody, for turning up. My name is Nyozan Eric Schutt. I'm a novice priest here, and I will be speaking today as our guiding teacher, Taigen Layton, is on sabbatical. How long do I have to speak? About a half hour, something like that? Okay. Yeah. First let's note, today is Pride Day. Millions of people, maybe a million in this city, millions around the country are celebrating. So I hope you will all join me in wishing all those people a joyful day, and I hope that you will share in that joy in some way. May all beings be happy. Here we go. I'll ask everybody to be patient with me. People who are less familiar with some of this, what we talk about here, may be confused by some things, and I apologize for that. And everybody else will be confused by other things because I'm not a particularly smooth or articulate speaker. Knock on wood, we'll do our best. We have a picture of a lotus up here. This is a very common kind of image from very early Buddhism, and very often we see it from above. So, you know, you see this beautifully formed lotus flower, you know, on various logos and pictures and stuff like that. And that's fine. But to me, that image, that sort of from above image, obscures the most interesting part about the image as a whole, which is that the lotus is noted, and this is why I believe it was chosen as a symbol, as a flower that blossoms out of, you know, ponds, swamps, muck, basically, down in the bottom of things. And there's a danger that if we, in our practice, are too focused on the sort of lovely, balanced, harmonious aspect of things, we may go a little bit astray because we miss that sort of transformative connection from the sort of, we might say, fruit, if we want to use that word, or blossom of the practice, which is actually, you know, completely and always and inevitably and ineradicably rooted in the mess of our lives, whoever we are, however long we've been practicing. So I'd like to keep that in mind. I'm going to throw a couple of balls up in the air, that's one, and the relation might not be clear. I'll try to bring them together in the end, and I hope it'll work. Dogen Zenji, who's the founder of the Japanese expression of our lineage, says some things that I think can be read in part as relating to this fact. Very famous work, Genjo Koan, which we might say the koan, the mystery of our lives. Famous piece, Genjo Koan, he says this, and I'm doing it in reverse order for a particular reason. He says, those who are greatly deluded about realization, we might say awakening or anything like that, are sentient beings, you and me, regular folks. Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. So it kind of, I think, points back down to that roots, telling us not to get too wrapped up in the inspiring images are concocted views of what it might be to be awake, to be a fully human and humane human being. You know, we need those things, but if we pay too much attention, particularly if we let it obscure that other side of things, we will encounter difficulties in our practice. He says in another piece, his first one, upon the first thing he wrote upon returning to Japan from China, Fukan Za Zengi, Universal Recommendation of for Zazen, telling us it might be a good idea if y'all practiced. He has a line that says, have no designs on being a Buddha. So this may, again, I think, be appropriately read as don't get too caught up in your images, because we are not fully awake, although we have that in us in some sense from the beginning. We're liable to trip ourselves up if we sort of create an image and go after it, because that image, by the very nature of things, will be a diluted image. It'll be a confused, at best, sort of sense. We need it. We are inspired by it, motivated by it, but we have to hold it a little loosely, perhaps. So again, you know, to return to the lotus metaphor, if we take that as a kind of a practice instruction, it directs our attention, I think, to something towards the roots of things, towards realization, awakening to appreciation, feeling of really how it is to be a human being. This realization, you know, in some sense is completely mysterious. Dogen's adamant that it's not an intellectual process. He, again, returning to Fukan Za Zengi, he says in Zazen we should put aside all involvements, suspend all affairs, do not think good and bad, do not judge true or false, give up the operations of the mind, intellect, and consciousness, and stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and views. I think I better skip that. I won't skip that. In Christian theology, you know, I said this process is mysterious, and in Christian theology, if I understand it, what is considered a mystery is a truth that is sort of not comprehensible, not tractable to reason. It's something that we only come to through revelation, divine revelation. And I think that that's actually very close to what we're doing in Zazen, this kind of giving up of these certain kinds of operations that Dogen talks about, and we might just substitute, you know, putting ourselves in the presence of truths that are available to us, again, not through reason, not through all these processes Dogen mentions, but through practice itself. It works pretty well. And if you go to a dictionary definition of what mysteriousness means, it says something like, at least in the American Heritage Dictionary, something that arouses wonder and inquiry. For those of us who were at this event the other night, there was a lot of talk about ongoing inquiry as a vital aspect of our practice. That said, Dogen's recommendations here, you know, are not any kind of a demonization of thought. You know, it's misguided, I think, in practice to think it's about the suppression of thought. and trying to get away from all that. It's a matter of suspending it in Zazen, in part, I think, because, without going too deeply into the mechanics of Zazen, part of what happens in the aspect of the stabilization, the calming, the settling that we come to in Zazen, the witnessing of the continual rising and falling of thoughts, sensations, feelings, confusion, greed, hate, and delusion, all those kinds of things, without intellectual processing, just directly sitting with it, being with it, is precisely that stabilization enables a kind of destabilization, a breaking up, a loosening up of all these kinds of things we spin out constantly about how we think we should be, how we think the world should be, what's going on. In a way that when that kind of breaks up and loosens up, then when we leave Zazen and go out to face the world, we're less shackled by that. And as a process, the inquiry that we're involved in Zazen can then be expressed more fluidly, more skillfully, more creatively, precisely in this realm of good, bad, yes, no, distinctions, thought, all that kind of thing. It's part of the reason why Duggan recommends Zazen. Now, I'd like to shift a little bit back to this image of the lotus and talk about an aspect briefly of my own practice. And it was stirred up by one of the teachers at this three-teacher event the other night, Wo Gu, mentioned in passing that as just kind of a natural expression of his own practice, he did such things as, rinsing out and reusing paper towels and rinsing plastic bags and so on and so forth. Excuse me. As a natural expression of his practice, and that was in a context of a conversation which another teacher, Meido, had noted, rightly I think, that samsara, this world we inhabit, and the way we experience it as beings who are not always totally awake, is not something that's going to be fixed. And drawing on other parts of the conversation, it's clear that in that sort of a practice, it's not a matter of holding up personal behavior. I'm washing my, rinsing out my paper towels, the world is going to be fixed. I'm rinsing out my paper towels, and you should too. And you should take this as a standard for your own practice. You might. And I was struck by it because as soon as he said that, a couple of people in the back of the rooms kind of like chuckled. Oh, God, that's crazy. But it's not crazy. It's just an expression of a natural response that seems to have arisen in his practice. And it's one that, it's the kind of thing that I kind of share myself. Again, not because I think that's going to take care of any of our problems particularly. But it puts me in contact. It's a natural response on my part. Yours might be entirely different to the encounter of my own meditative experience with the pain, suffering of the world. And I'll explain a little bit how that works, maybe. I don't know. I don't know if it'll be clear. A Vietnamese Buddhist teacher, many of you know, some may not be aware of him, Thich Nhat Hanh, has a very famous, often quoted or alluded to illustration of what he calls interbeing. I think that's actually a very good term. But interbeing refers to what we technically call in Dharma dependent co-arising. One aspect of that is, or that closely overlaps with the central concept of shunya or emptiness, the lack of inherent identity for any person or thing, and it directs our attention to the fluidity of things as process, and highlights the way that the world as we experience it commonly is largely the product of distinctions, dualities, dichotomies, judgments that we make. And he, I think in the image, he talks about a piece of paper, and he's saying, this is a piece of paper. What is this piece of paper really? And he talks about, the paper as an expression of the total ensemble, a particular expression of the total ensemble of causes and conditions, which he illustrates. He says, paper's made from trees, so, we're talking about sun, we're talking about rain, we're talking about earth. We're talking about the lumberjack who felled a tree, and the guy in the pulp mill who made it into pulp, and the trucker who delivered the reams of paper to Best Buy, and all that kind of thing. And it's an image that it's kind of sweet, It's nice. It's moving to be acquainted with that, reminded of that, and to acknowledge to ourselves that all things are of that nature. That I am of that nature, that you are of that nature, or as they might put it in earlier Buddhism, that what we call self is entirely constituted without residue of non-self things. That's true. I believe that's true. I believe it's a perfectly, probably the most accurate, very general, but accurate way to understand in one aspect things of the world. But that kind of highlights only one aspect of what we call the three marks of existence, these three very general characteristics of all things, all dharmas, all things we experience, which are, one of them is anatman, precisely this idea of non-inherent selfhood, very mysterious concept, but something that one can experience. It sets aside directly address the aspect of impermanence, although when you think about all the transformation involved in that kind of process, clearly it's there. But what I would like to highlight is that it doesn't highlight, and part of the reason we experience that is this very warm image, is that it doesn't bring to our attention the third aspect, which is the third mark of existence, which is dukkha, the mess, the suffering, the muck out of which our practice grows. And it doesn't take long to see this if we look for it. For example, we can say this piece of paper, just this very one, indirectly but intimately involves me with, the end of that tree that was felled, with all the noxious things that are so destabilizing in our atmosphere that are released from, say, a chainsaw or a truck, with the exhaustion and the, hemorrhoids, speed problem maybe a guy who's spending 15 hours a day in a truck, you know? So while, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh's image is totally accurate, there's a tendency, again, to see the lotus from above and let it obscure this other side. And I think that's part of what Dogen is encouraging us to be open to discover in our zazen, precisely so that we can have not a judgmental, not necessarily yardsticky kind of thing by which we might judge other people or ourselves and find ourselves, you know, good boys or bad boys, or anything like that, but precisely so that we can, in our lives, respond, however, in a way that comes out of the natural insight and compassion that we uncover in our practice. Not so much in the sense that we're going to, like, in and of that, you know, through those things themselves directly fix the world, but it gives us a kind of intimate, close way of being in the world, so that we, when we are on the highway and we see a sea of cars, it's not, you know, a matter of doing a lot of, you know, evaluation of right and wrong, thinking good and bad, all those kinds of things that Dogen mentions in Fukan Zazengi, although those things clearly have a role, but a sense of you start to directly see it. I mean, you feel it. The world appears differently. And then, with that sort of increased sensitivity, you might say, with the loosening of our thought, with that, you know, what some teachers talk about as unknowingness or opening the hand of thought, then, you know, start to concretely and more skillfully respond. And again, not because we're going to fix something that may be unfixable, but simply because our practice is a bodhisattva practice and we can work together. Some things shift, some things change, we grow, we develop. You know, and so I use the image of this sheet of paper as a concrete manifestation of my, again, indirect but intimate involvement with all the suffering that's happening out there, my own, yours. But I think that actually has quite a general, it's not restricted to say, you know, how we consume, although that's huge. I mean, it's like when I consider, I recently learned that these, you know, single-use plastic bottles, you know, we might get a drink of water out of, a million of those are produced every minute, right? Day in, day out. Despite all our best efforts, our per capita energy usage as Americans went up approximately a little over 2% between 2016, 2017, just sort of year after year it happens. And, you know, we're all involved in that through our gadgets, through our habits, through our consumption, everything. That's from the U.S. Energy Information Agency. You know, what do you do about that? We don't exactly know, but, you know, it evokes, you don't have to think about it, it evokes certain kinds of responses. Likewise, you know, we're celebrating Pride Day today. You know, when we examine the muck of our lives and we sort of get this sort of sensitivity, this alertness to all that's unfolding in our life and the ways we've been conditioned and so on, at least introduces somebody like me, a heterosexual male, a willingness, a desire, actually, to take on the discomfort, the embarrassment, the shame of my own sort of inevitable imbrication with all the sort of, you know, homophobic, cruel kinds of things that have expressed themselves in our culture. And with that can come a willingness for further examination, to converse with people, to understand these things, and to hopefully over time shift these things. Not that I'm like a, you know, a raving homophobe or anything like that, not at all, but you know, it would be simply false to pretend that it's not there and to say, you know, oh, those problems, you know, those are somebody else's problems. I am not involved in that. I am. You are. Likewise, the things on the southern border, right? It's terrible, terrible stuff. Somebody, I think it was Dylan, in one of the emails, was talking about, well, you know, this comes out of, you know, people wanting to get things, being greedy, and then sort of imposing, and, you know, it's sort of in reference to the conditions in largely Central America that produce these things. That's absolutely true. But who are, you know, this is like, who are the beneficiaries of that? Well, we are, you know, in this kind of very imbalanced, destabilized, greed-motivated, hatred-involved systems of unwholesome relationships that we, as Americans, have with other people in the world. And so I, you know, again, it's not very comfortable. It's kind of yucky. It's mucky. But I think in our practice, you know, in its bodhisattvic aspect, we have to invite it and welcome it, examine it. Not, again, in Zazen. We're not, like, in Zazen, like, trying to sort all this out. But something arises that, as I say, you know, creates the conditions to start destabilizing how we think, how we talk, how we appreciate, that then, you know, helps further create the possibilities collectively, individually, for making our broken world that won't be fixed, at least less broken, maybe a little kinder. And we don't know how, you know, ultimately all this plays out. We just don't. We wish we did. Sometimes, you know, I think other people, you know, want some teacher somewhere to tell them, you know, how they should think about things, what they should do. I think that's a mistake, both for the student as a Zen student and for teachers if they fall into the trap of thinking that they can propose it. It's much subtler. All these processes are much subtler, more mysterious. This is my opinion. This is my view. And it's, you know, it's, again, we're back in the realm of discourse, considerations of right and wrong, judgment. So it's only a view. It's my view. But I put it before you and, you know, invite you to maybe consider it in when you're kind of looking at your own life and looking at your own practice. So I'll stop there and just say again, may all beings be happy. Thank you. And if anybody's got a question or a comment, criticism, this would be the time. Yes. Hi. What's your name?
Oh, my name's Nate.
Nate, thanks for coming today.
So I guess
congratulations, yeah, or condolences, however you look at it. Duplicity?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, of course, a lot of that comes through practice and study. And I just wanted to ask you, like, where you are as a novelist, what are your teachers?
What are my teachers?
Teachers.
Or teaching. Well, you know, we have wonderful people in the world like Okamura Roshi. We have my own teacher, Taigen, people like that who guide us in practice. And then I have the guidance of my dismay and lack of comprehension, understanding about all these difficult things that are happening, right? You know, and then I have my interactions with people and situations in the world, and the information that comes from that. I mean, you know, I don't mean to be squishy or facetious about it, but you know, we say in our Bodhisattva vow, I forget what we say. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter all of them. And more and more, that's kind of my experience, that if I'm open to it, everything that will arise in my life can be a teacher and can teach and inform, you know, fully acknowledging that moment to moment, most often in the interest of consolidating sense of self and trying to protect that. You know, I'm rejecting that. But to the extent that I can meet it, everything is my teacher and all beings are my teacher. You're welcome. Aishin?
Of continuing to inquire and continuing to educate ourselves. I think with a lot of these topics, what comes to mind are things like vegetarianism, recycling, racism, homophobia. We have a tendency to want to fix it within ourselves and then not think about it anymore. And that is such a mistake.
We want to be a lotus, right?
Yeah, you know, these things, they can't be fixed, but we can continue, and part of fixing them is continuing to educate ourselves and to educate others, and if we get to that place of feeling like, well, I've got, you know, I do this, and so that's what everyone should do, we really go astray from being part of all beings and helping all beings wake up together. It's really only in our recognition of the pervasiveness of these issues and how they go beyond just our own individual actions that we can be of any help. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I mean, at some point we've got to you know, we all have different Dharma positions. We all play different roles, right, in the world. And so in some sense, yes, I can say, you know what this politician is doing is really problematic, and I feel it's incumbent on me to join with others and do everything we can to make things be different. But it's not particularly helpful to sort of let it go there and think, you know, that's his problem, man. You know, I've got it tied up. I've got my understanding. I've got my, you know, groovy practice going on. I'm okay. You know, that's precisely, that is the fundamental delusion, the delusion of separate self. You know, and if we can get over that, then we see that, you know, even though we all occupy different places, we call it Dharma positions, fundamentally, our Dharma position is entirely constituted by our involvement with every other Dharma position. There is no way, in some sense, you know, I mean, yes, we hold people responsible, we hold ourselves responsible, but the difficulties are not mine and not yours. And that's part of what makes it hard to work effectively with.
And we don't want to create others while we try to address.
Right, as a way of, partly, as an interested process in which we deny our own responsibility and involvement. Right? Hi, Hoketsu.
Good morning. Bodhisattva. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Lots of images. And I like the image, like, you know, I fully agree that I love Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching, but I was always made a little uneasy that they're so sweet. Maybe because I like to cook, I like to add other ingredients besides just sweetness. And the image of, you know, like the lumberjack, you know, and the truck driver on speed, you know, roaring around with logs to make the paper that you just used for your Dharma talk. And I think of that, and I think it's also including the people who perpetrate or who appear to be perpetrating suffering, you know, and that there's like a practice doesn't, you know, includes all that pain, but also I feel like there's a sweetness to like a pig rolling around in dirt. You know, like I feel like we roll around in the mud and have to coat ourselves in the mud of the world, you know, and not just like wash it off. You know, there's this idea of it's so pure, we're going to get rid of it, you know. But there's something about, there's a tenderness to that, of showing the same love and sensitivity towards, you know, somebody willfully depriving a child of a clean diaper or bed, or, you know, things that are going on in this world, the pollution or, you know, whatever we want to, you know, choose, take care of poison. But there's something that's a harder part in practice, I think. So how do you work with that?
Remember that part of it that I said about don't let anybody try to tell you how you work with that beyond, I mean, concretely.
I'm asking for advice.
I mean, I think it's you know, the what we should ask when we ask that question, and the answers that should be given is that the way we work with it as people who are directly involved in a particular practice is work with the instructions that, and they're very vague. You know, it's hard to, as I was saying, you don't see the, like, immediate direct applicability. You can't list off, you know, you meditate and then this, that happens in you and in the world. But we follow those instructions and for zazen and for the practice of precepts. And, you know, precisely that kind of sensitivity and appreciation, openness, insight, compassion has a chance to arise. So I think that's where we start. Is that at all satisfying, or does that seem like a dodge?
Sometimes it just feels so hard.
It's hard. It's hard. That's the thing, you know, again, about the, you know, the sweetness. You know, I like that word. You know, we have mindfulness. You know, we have this idea that we're going to come, you know, if we sit and diligently meditate, somehow we will just experience love and light. And, you know, that Dogen says, you know, when one side is illuminated, the other side of it is dark. It's true. I mean, there is, through practice, the experience of love, if you want to put it that way, we hope, and light and joy. But the nitty-gritty of day-to-day practice is going to involve a lot of discomfort, a lot of sort of flushing out of our ancient twisted karma that we're, as individuals and as a culture, deeply, deeply troubled in a way that we try to hide, first from ourselves and then sort of secondarily from everybody else. It's like a, you know, to go back to the lotus and the pig and all that, it's a gritty, muddy process, I think. Sometimes we come to practice because we, and it's quite legitimate, we come to practice because we're in pain. We want the pain to stop. But the process itself is not by, you know, engaging in elaborate ways of trying to obscure and hide that pain from ourselves and others, but to truly, truly, deeply experience it. Yeah. You're welcome. Yes, hi. What's your name?
Iris.
Iris. Hi, welcome.
Thanks for love, something that helped me a lot with this is, you know,
if there's so much that's beyond concepts, right? But we have to use concepts to interact with people in the world. And maybe I'll just say this all wrong, but you know, we doing wholesome things, avoiding unwholesome, is kind of pointing us in a direction, and then, which is great. And then as soon as we feel like we're really grasping something, we're like, I'm a good person. I don't use plastic. I don't whatever. You know, then we're grasping hard on something. And as soon as we catch it, then we know, well, that's not beyond concept anymore. So sit that down, and then you know, try again. And we're always going to go in the right direction, grasp it, let go. Go in the right direction, grasp it, let go. And that there's never an end to that. That is our practice. That is how.
And that has to be motivated by, you know, a sustained sort of intentionality about doing that. And this refers back to the sort of discomfort I was talking about. It's like, you know, I don't know how I'm changing over time, but my experience is that more and more I see that all of those times that I'm doing that, my judgments, you know, largely in terms of people. I mean, I'm not going to embarrass myself by sort of revealing, you know, how many times I've done that this morning with all of you in different ways. But it's a constant process. And I'm grateful that it's constant, because before I was not seeing it. You know, there was less of this and more of this. You know, and, you know, God, I mean, our hands are these miracles of agility and usefulness. This usually has just a couple of uses, you know. And, you also referred to our vows. I will note that we've gone over our time. You talked about the impossibility of doing this, so let us repeat our impossible vows three times. Beings are...